You are listening to A Scary State, and this week we're covering West Virginia. So, Lauren?
Yes, Nora?
Let's get scary. All right, well, I guess some things have happened since we last recorded.
Yes, some things have happened.
What happened, Lauren?
Okay, so I guess we're just going to give a really big thank you. I don't know what happened. Okay, well, I do. Nora was awesome. And we just got a ton of new followers, so welcome. It's just, it's incredible.
It's like a, is it undescribable or indescribable?
Indescribable.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's an indescribable feeling, like working so hard on something and then actually, I don't want to say seeing it pay off because we had like awesome people supporting us, but
yes.
Like gaining traction.
Gaining traction.
Yeah.
Yes.
It feels really good.
Yeah.
So.
It was just exciting. We saw some numbers of ours today and I legit thought it was wrong.
Yeah. So she texted me and she's like, I think the, program we use to like track our downloads is broken.
I think it's glitching. And so I like redid it a couple of times and I kept getting the same number and I was like, this is wrong. Like there's no way. So it's just really exciting. I've had a smile on my face all day long. It's just so
same.
Cool.
Yeah. So everyone who's followed us on Instagram and Facebook, thank you so much. We're so excited to have you join our little family and we hope that you enjoy everything that's to come.
Yeah. And everyone who's been here from the beginning, thank you for also sticking around. We
yes.
also really, really appreciate
yes.
it.
Yes.
So I have a weird thing to tell you. Okay. At work, I don't know what it is, but I see the same guy around work all the time. And to the point where like we go down for breakfast at the same time every day and I'll see him every day. And then my friend will be like, hey, do you want to go get coffee at like 11:30? And I'm like, yeah, okay. He's there. Then I'll go get lunch at like 12:13. He's there. I don't know what it is, but I see him every single day, multiple times a day. I don't know where he works.
Does he work?
I don't. Okay. See, I want to say that, but then I also see him.
Yeah.
So. But it's so weird. And so this morning I was talking with like my breakfast crew and we were just like chatting and he walks by and of course everyone gets really awkward and quiet because we know this is the man I see all the frickin' time.
Oh my gosh.
Like I left on Tuesday. And as I'm walking out of the building, he's walking out the exact same time. And I'm like, what is going on?
Oh my gosh. Well, I have something about my work that's pretty – it made me think of you the other day.
Aww.
So for those of you who are new here, Lauren hates elevators. She does not do elevators.
Yeah.
And the elevators in my building – so it's a pretty old building, but the elevators are like very creaky. Like you'll get to the floor and the doors won't open for a little while.
No.
And it's just really weird like that.
No.
So, and it's kind of known for breaking down, but.
And you still go
yeah.
on it.
Because it's never broken down with me in it.
It just takes one time.
Huh? I know.
It just
I know,
takes
I
one
know.
Time to ruin your life.
I know. But so I got into work the other day and one of the elevators had a bright red sign on the door that said, this elevator has been deemed unsafe by the county or something like that. And I was like, okay, I really need to start taking the stairs.
Uh-uh.
Mm-mm. I did take the other elevator that day, but
Nora.
I will
Nora.
Start taking the stairs.
If that is not the universe saying do not take these dangerous metal boxes.
I know. But someone else got in the elevator with me, so I was like, okay, we die together. I didn't say that, but I thought it.
This one girl I work with, there's an elevator in our parking garage that is apparently known for breaking down, yet people still go in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so she got on it one day, and there was someone else on there with her, and the doors closed. And then the person was like, oh, I heard this elevator broke down today.
No.
So my friend was like, why would you tell me that as the doors close and I have nowhere else to go?
Oh, my gosh.
They were fine, but still.
Okay, real quick about elevators also. So I enjoy watching shows like Live Rescue where like they'll like rescue people.
Oh,
I like the rescue stuff. So the firefighters got a call that people were stuck in the elevator. And literally, so they go get the people out, shut down the elevator. But someone keeps like removing the sign that it's shut down. And so people keep getting in it and they keep getting called back.
And I
they
hate
keep
having, it.
It was like they went back multiple times. I was like,
oh
this, could you imagine also like just trying to save people's lives
oh
as a firefighter and you keep getting called back for elevator issues because they won't stay out of it because the sign keeps like I cannot.
They have to do that thing where they keep the elevator doors open, you know,
yeah.
like where it's just sitting there. So if you get on, it like won't ever open for you
yeah.
or like won't ever close.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think they were shutting it down and somehow it was turning back on.
No.
I know.
Demon elevator.
What a nightmare.
All right. Well, today we're talking about West Virginia. So our state facts are that West Virginia is nicknamed the Mountain State and joined the Union on July 20th, 1893, when it separated from Virginia and became the 35th state. It would have been the 24th state if the secession of 11 other southern states were taken into account. West Virginia got its name because it separated from Virginia and is to the west. Some weird laws. You can take roadkill home for dinner. This law is actually celebrated by the Roadkill Festival that takes place in Marlington. But don't worry. No real roadkill is eaten at this festival, just animals that are typically those who become roadkill. So like,
oh, that's interesting.
Deer, things like that. It usually takes place on September 24th.
I wonder if they have like raccoon and skunk.
Probably.
Or fox.
Oh, I don't know.
Those
don't
are like, I see, I know, I see those though, like
as roadkill.
I saw a raccoon
today. I know, it's really sad.
Yeah.
It is illegal to sneeze on a train. Which would not be good for me. A person shall be fined $1 for every time they swear in public. And this is really sad, but if you live in Alderson, you're not allowed to walk a lion, tiger, or leopard, even if they are on a leash. So sorry for all you big cat owners.
Tiger King could not live
right
there. Well, and he's in jail, so he couldn't.
All right, this is a really important thing.
Okay.
The famous song, Take Me Home Country Roads by John Denver, was actually written about Western Virginia.
I was hoping you would
not
say that fact.
West Virginia.
I was hoping you would say that.
So the Blue Ridge Mountains and Shenandoah River are primarily located in Virginia, yeah, not West Virginia. And it is believed that when he sings West Virginia, it is a lowercase W, meaning Western Virginia, not
and
the state of West Virginia.
Yeah, and it doesn't sound as good if you're like Western Virginia. Like
exactly.
West Virginia sounds better.
But
so
if
that's...
you look at the lyrics, it's a lowercase W.
Wow.
Meaning that it's West Virginia, not the state West Virginia. So us Virginia people are very adamant
yeah,
about this
it's
song.
It's like a thing because like West Virginia people, like the state West Virginia people try to claim that song.
And it's not
even
theirs.
Like West Virginia University.
Yes.
And I have heard before like it was not intended for that.
Nope.
So.
Western Virginia. Yeah. We claim it. In 1888, Graham Hamrick acquired some corpses from the West Virginia Hospital for the Insane, now the Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum. He kept them and made them into mummies. These mummies are now being kept at the Barber County Historical Museum. Mothman also is known for really originating from Point Pleasant. Here, one can see the Mothman statue and even attend the annual Mothman Festival. So,
ooh.
Nora, it is September 17th and 18th of next year. We should go.
Wow.
It would be a quick little drive for
us. It would
us,
be a quick drive.
So we should totally do it.
Okay.
A house in Canova is known as the Pumpkin House. Every year in the fall, the owner, Rick Griffith, and many volunteers carve about 3,000 pumpkins and put them around his house for all to see. And let me tell you, the picture looks awesome.
Really?
It's really, really cool. I'll show you.
Oh, I thought you had to hold up.
And then West Virginia has two identified serial killers and one unidentified serial killer.
Wow.
So, what are you telling us about today, Nora?
Okay. So, like last week's episode, this week I am covering a story that is super similar to a past story that you covered.
Oh?
Yes, it is very similar to your Wisconsin story.
Mm-hmm. I saw this one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So you know which one?
Oh, yes.
It's so similar.
Because I was looking at that one and I was like, ooh. But then I was like, ooh, I can't bring myself down that road right now.
Oh, yeah. I was like, see, I feel like I can do it to myself since you had the emotional like trauma of doing that, the last one.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, I can do it. So let's dive in.
Oh, but I'm glad you're covering it because I was interested to hear this one.
Yeah. So Skylar Annette Neese was born on February 10th, 1996 in Morgantown, West Virginia. She was the only child of Mary and Dave Neese. Mary Neese worked as an administrative assistant in a cardiac lab and David Neese was a product assembler at Walmart. Skylar's parents absolutely adored her. She was their only child and
no.
She was just the light of their lives. I saw a few home videos of Skylar on the news from when she was like 4 or 5, and you can tell how close and happy the family was.
Yeah.
So that made it even harder to research this.
Ugh.
Something else I'll say about this case is like usually I try to stick with doing my research and not go down rabbit holes, but I went
so
down rabbit holes on this one because it was just unbelievable.
It's hard to not go down a rabbit hole.
Yeah. So to give you a little background on Skylar, she was a student at University High School who wanted to become a criminal defense lawyer. She worked at Wendy's part-time while she attended high school. On July 5th, 2012, when Skylar was 16 years old, she returned to her family's Star City, West Virginia apartment after working a shift at Wendy's. Skylar had gotten a text from her two best friends, Sheila Eddy and Rachel Schoaf, to sneak out with them. Skylar and these two girls had previously been super close. They were both the only child and attended the same school and liked to smoke together. Unfortunately, Skylar had recently fallen out with her two best friends, so she was initially hesitant to sneak out with them. Mm-hmm. But her two friends were calling and texting her and asking her to sneak out and discussing the plans of what they'd do that night. Ugh. And yeah.
And at that age, you're like, okay.
And the FOMO hits.
Yup.
So Skylar was probably hoping to, like, mend her rocky relationship with them. I mean, I remember mean girls in high school and just trying to mend things with mm-hmm. them. And we all know that that's not something mm-hmm. you want to go down.
Nope.
But she did decide to go ahead and join them. Skylar's apartment complex surveillance video shows that she left the apartment via her bedroom window at 12:30 a.m. on the morning of July 6th, crossed the street, and got into a four-door sedan, which police later determined was her friend Sheila's car. Skylar's father said she did not take her cell phone charger with her and her window was left open, which to him were telltale signs that she had planned on coming home.
Yeah, definitely.
So the three girls headed northwest from Star City toward Blackville, West Virginia. Her two friends had planned to travel along West Virginia Route 7, but turned around after spotting a state police car parked in front of a gambling lounge. Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, Skylar had no idea why the girls were focusing so hard on dodging police, but she probably figured that they were just looking for a good place to pull over and smoke.
I mean, I get that. I mean, I would try to dodge police if I were at my age now driving around at night.
Yeah.
You know, nothing suspicious going on. It's just that would be scary.
Yeah, exactly. That's something the three girls did together often, so this would have been normal for Skylar. The three eventually arrived at their destination just across from the Pennsylvania state border, a spot where all three of the girls had occasionally smoked together in the past.
Okay.
Once the girls were out of the vehicle, Sheila and Rachel told Skylar that they had forgotten to bring a lighter. Skylar volunteered to go back to the vehicle to grab her own lighter. Once Skylar had turned her back, Sheila and Rachel counted to three, which was their previously agreed upon signal, came up behind Skylar and began to stab her repeatedly. Skylar attempted to run for her life, but she was only able to run a few feet before Rachel tackled her to the ground and continued the assault. Skylar managed to wrestle Rachel's knife from her. In an attempt to defend herself, she cut Rachel's knee. Sheila continued to stab Skylar until there was complete silence.
Oh my God.
This next sentence is really graphic and disturbing. But according to Rachel, quote, Skylar's neck stopped making gurgling sounds, end quote.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And that's how they knew that she was gone.
Nora.
I know. Skylar's post-mortem examination revealed more than 50 stab wounds. Do you remember how many were in Slenderman?
19.
Okay. Still horrible, mm-hmm. but... Sheila and Rachel attempted to bury Skylar's body and dragged her to the side of the road, but the road ran along a creek and the soil there was too hard and rocky to dig a hole. They instead covered Skylar's body with rocks, fallen branches, and dirt. They returned to the car to clean themselves and the murder scene, then left the scene, disposed of the blood-soaked clothing, and returned to their homes. Name something more terrifying than
yeah.
that. That is horrible.
Like, just thinking about it, that's horrible.
Yeah. Skylar was initially considered by law enforcement authorities to be a runaway, and an Amber Alert was not immediately issued in connection with her disappearance. Hmm. An early tip indicated that Skylar had been seen in North Carolina, but the Star City Police Department determined that the person spotted was not Skylar.
So I have a weird thing with Amber Alerts. Is it true? I read somewhere that it can only be considered an Amber Alert if the person is believed to have been taken by someone who knows them.
If the person was believed to be abducted.
Because I thought that was it too, but then I read somewhere weird that an Amber Alert is different from like something else. I can't remember what it was, but there was like some case and it was like they couldn't issue an Amber Alert because they didn't think that the person knew her or like who took the person.
So I think that actually Amber Alerts differ a little bit from state to state
because
there's changes and like different stipulations, and we're going to dive into that later.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Skylar's parents didn't let any false leads or sightings deter them from finding their daughter. Her parents posted flyers about their missing daughter in the Monongahela County region, which is right at the West Virginia border near Pennsylvania. Meanwhile, in the investigation, police determined that the unknown sedan in which Skylar was last seen belonged to Sheila, and they interviewed her. Sheila admitted to picking up Skylar, but stated that she had dropped her off an hour later. The FBI and the West Virginia State Police joined the search for Skylar on September 10, 2012, and began interviewing her school friends. In those interviews, several classmates admitted to overhearing conversations between Rachel and Sheila about the murder plot, but didn't report it because they thought the two were joking. I don't want to be judgmental because I don't know what it was like for them, but if I heard two people talking about murdering their best friend,
yeah,
I wouldn't think it was a joke.
I would want to tell like a principal or something. Like someone.
Even like if you anonymously tell if you don't want to get involved, you know? So that's freaking scary. Then on January 3rd, 2013, about 6 months after the murder, there was a huge break in the case. Rachel had had a nervous breakdown.
One of them always.
Yes. She admitted to police that she had plotted with Sheila to kill Skylar and that the pair had followed through with their plan. In fact, Sheila and Rachel had been planning Skylar's murder for months before it took place. And of course, you know, they probably got pretty sloppy about where they talked about it since people were overhearing it.
Yeah, and because when you're that young, you think like, you know, no one's going to hear anything. We're totally fine. Like, you know, like no one's going to suspect anything.
Invincible thing, I guess.
Exactly.
So the pair had left Sheila's home that evening of the murder and prepared to carry out the assault on Skylar. Hello, first-degree murder charges, because it was premeditated. AF. And brought with them the kitchen knives, paper towels, bleach, cleaning cloths, clean clothes, and a shovel.
Oh my gosh. They like actually really planned this.
Yes. They concealed the knives in their purses and hid the remaining items in the trunk of Sheila's car. Skylar's blood was later found in that car. Mm. The motivation Rachel gave for the murder was that they, quote, didn't like her and, quote, didn't want to be friends with her anymore.
Then just stop being friends.
Exactly. Just stop being friends. Wow. I don't get it. David Neese stated that these two girls were among his daughter's best friends and that Sheila had even helped the family by distributing missing person flyers. It's always the people who want to get involved who are like part of it, like unfortunately. After her confession, Rachel led investigators to Skylar's body. On March 13th, 2013, U.S. Attorney William J. Illenfeld II issued a press release stating that a body was found in Wayne Township, which is in Greene County, Pennsylvania, on January 16th, 2013, and it had been identified as the body of Skylar Neese. Mm. Skylar's body was found less than 30 miles away from her house.
Jeez.
On May 1st, 2013, Rachel pled guilty to second-degree murder and was sentenced to 30 years in prison with eligibility for parole after 10 years.
Dang.
Yeah. She was tried as an adult.
And how old was she?
16.
Okay.
Yeah.
Dang.
Yeah. But according to Rachel's plea agreement, she pled guilty to murder in the second degree by unlawfully, willfully, maliciously, and intentionally causing the death of Skylar Neese by stabbing her and causing fatal injuries, end quote. She got second degree murder because she led authorities to the body, gave them tons of information, and she was a minor even though she was tried as an adult. I think they considered all of those things.
Yeah, probably.
So she was recommended for a sentence of 20 years. After 10 years, she'll be up for parole, which is coming up.
Yeah, because when did this happen?
This happened in 2012. Well, I guess she started her sentence in 13, and then so that would make it 2023.
Dang. Yeah. Ugh.
Yeah. Then on September 4th, 2013, West Virginia prosecutors publicly identified Sheila as the second alleged perpetrator of the murder of Skylar and announced that she would be tried as an adult. Just like, I mean, Rachel was tried too, but
exactly,
Sheila,
yeah.
They're like trying to pull at her to get her to like cooperate, basically. Sheila was indicted by a grand jury on September 6, 2013 on one count of kidnapping, one count of first-degree murder, and one count of conspiracy to commit murder.
Dang.
Get this. She pled not guilty. Like, really? I feel like if you're so guilty that the person you did it with admitted to being guilty and, like, they have all this evidence, when you plead not guilty, it's way worse for you because the court takes that into consideration of, like, you're not coming clean and you're not setting a good example for the courts.
Yep.
So they will make an example out of you.
Yep.
So that was not smart.
And then you can't do like a plea deal. You like kind of lose all of those options.
Exactly. Yeah. But Sheila realized that she faced the prospect of additional charges from Pennsylvania authorities, so she changed her plea from guilty of first degree murder, and on January 24th, 2014, she was sentenced to life in prison with mercy. So that means that she's eligible for parole after 15 years.
Oh. Yeah. That's a term I haven't heard before. Mm-hmm.
I don't like that term in this case, because why does she get mercy?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's not, it's not well worded.
Yeah, it's not. Pennsylvania authorities did not file charges as per the plea deal following her guilty plea. Sheila had never publicly expressed any remorse for the murder, but Rachel's family did publicly apologize, and it's said that Rachel was very remorseful.
Aww.
Yeah.
There's always one who's, like, really remorseful and really sorry about it, the one who always cracks.
Yeah.
And then there's the other one who's just like, you know, it happened.
Yeah.
It's done.
Exactly. And I think, obviously, that's no excuse for Rachel for her
behavior. No, not at all.
Right, but I get what you're saying, though. And, like, I think that Sheila definitely was the driver of it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, like, kind of like the mastermind behind
exactly.
it all.
Exactly, yeah. Today, both women are incarcerated at the Lakin Correctional Center in Mason County. I actually came across Sheila's Twitter account, which I literally was on her Twitter for an hour last night looking at her old tweets, and I wrote down some of the craziest ones.
And wait, so how old were they when this happened?
So they
were 16.
I think by the time they actually were in prison, they were 17.
Okay, so then now they'd be around not yet 27, like probably 23-ish. Right?
Yeah.
Or 25-ish?
Yeah, right now they're around 25.
Oh, wow.
So they're a few years younger. When I came across Sheila's Twitter account, it sealed the deal for me that this girl has no regrets and did not understand the severity of what was happening around her.
No regrets.
Yeah. So on January 10th, which was 7 days after Rachel went to police, she tweeted, "My biggest fear is falling asleep in the tanning bed, and then bam, you awkwardly come out of the room 2 hours later." Clearly no regard for what is going on around her.
Yeah. Then and how old are you that you're going to a tanning bed?
I know.
Excuse me? And yeah. If you're going to a good place, they turn off after a certain amount of time.
Yeah, I thought you had to be 18. But I read her tweet. She tweeted about going with her mom. So I think if you have like a guardian, you can do it.
Huh.
Which I don't know.
I've only tanned 5 times in my entire life, and it was right before the wedding, and that was it.
Nice.
It was actually kind of nice, but I was like, I'm not spending this much money to tan.
I know. We had a free bed in college, and I was like, I'll do it now, and then I'll stop. January 17th, she tweeted, like, shut up, please. I'm begging you. So she probably knows at this point Rachel's talking.
Mm-hmm.
January 26th, she said, I probably need to start taking things more seriously, but some things are just such a joke. Like, is this really happening? Yes, it's really happening, sweetheart.
It seems like she has a disconnect with
absolutely.
Reality.
Absolutely. On February 8th, she tweeted 2 things. She tweeted, you, my friend, are the definition of a psychopath. And then she tweeted, it's pretty awesome that I can block someone from my thoughts completely as if they never existed. So I think she's talking about herself when she says the psychopath thing.
Literally exactly what I thought.
March 30th. This tweet gave me goosebumps.
Okay.
She said, think about what I'm going to say. She said, we really did go on 3.
Oh, my God.
She confessed in that tweet.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh, that gave me goosebumps. Oh, I don't like that.
Yeah. I know. I have a few more. April 28th, she said, I hate seeing or hearing things that remind me of you because you're the last person I want to be reminded of. April 29th, I don't know why girls complain about guys. Girls are just as bad or probably worse. LOL.
Oh.
We all suck.
Oh.
Her last tweet ever was April 30th, and she said, ugh, why? The next day, she was sentenced to 30 years in prison.
Oh.
Yeah. I'm sharing these tweets because I think it's fascinating, but also like super disturbing to see inside her mind.
And it's weird because you're kind of seeing a snapshot in history.
You
know,
yeah.
Like this happened so long ago and you're just seeing kind of exactly what she was thinking around this time and then it's just done.
Yep. And the day after she and Rachel committed the murder, she tweeted a picture with her other friend and said, happy birthday, like just completely acting normal. It's so disturbing. She started spiraling towards the end, definitely, and made it all public.
Dang. Did they use any of her tweets in court?
I actually don't know, but I don't know that they needed to.
Yeah.
Because they had so much evidence. I mean, it would make sense to, but I feel like she could have deleted them or deleted her Twitter if she was worried about it.
It seems like how they were talking about it and how they were acting that they really did think they were invincible.
Oh, yeah.
So if you think you are, there's no reason why you're going to delete something because you're not doing anything wrong.
That's very true. She probably didn't. And then she was arrested the next day, so she probably didn't get a chance to delete stuff.
Jeez. Did her parents ever comment?
Her parents never publicly apologized, never really said anything. Honestly, I from what I saw, they seemed to be a little similar to her in the sense of they were kind of aloof with everything, whereas Rachel's parents were like, you know, all the feelings, you know, knew how horrible this was.
Yeah.
So definitely polar opposites there, but I would say no, I didn't see anything about them apologizing.
Interesting.
Yeah. So there was a silver lining that came out of this case because a huge flaw in the Amber Alert system was uncovered and corrected in West Virginia. So to give some background on the old system, an Amber Alert was not issued in Skylar's disappearance because the circumstances did not meet all four criteria for an alert to be issued. Number one, a child is believed to be abducted. Number two, the child is under 18. Number three, the child may be in danger or death or serious injury. Number four, there is sufficient information to indicate the Amber Alert would be helpful. So rule number one is absurd because not just being abducted, that's not the only way to get murdered.
Yeah. Is that the reason why they didn't think it was all four?
So I think because the child may be in danger of death or serious injury, because I think it was that as well, because they thought that she was a runaway. So they were like, we don't think she's in danger. Basically, you can be lured somewhere. It's not just because, you know, of being abducted.
And then with the abducted part too, like you can willingly get into the car, but if you can't get out of the car willingly, or you can't, you know, like you can't get out of the situation willingly, then right there you're being held against your will.
Exactly. So on top of these four rules, a waiting period of 48 hours has to elapse before a teenager can be considered missing. Yeah. A West Virginia state legislator from the Nice Family Home District introduced a bill called Skylar's Law to modify West Virginia's Amber Alert plan to issue immediate public announcements when a child is reported missing and in danger, regardless of whether the child is believed to have been kidnapped.
Good.
Yeah. On March 27, 2013, the West Virginia House of Delegates approved Skylar's Law with a 98-0 vote, and it was signed into law in May of 2013. Skylar's dad also transformed the wooded area where Skylar's body was found into a memorial.
Aww.
I know. When asked about the memorial in a 2020 interview, he said, quote, "Something horrible happened here, but I wanted to take the horrible thing that happened here and try to turn it into something good, a place that people can come and remember Skylar and remember the good little girl she was and not the little beast that they treated her like," end quote.
Oh.
Yeah. So there was a silver lining, but still horrible case.
Yeah.
And not far from us, which is really scary.
Yeah.
And they're going to be up for parole soon, which is really scary.
Yeah. All not good.
Yeah.
And it just – what worries me when they come up for parole when something happens when they're young is that they usually are said like, oh, this much time has passed. This is all the things they've done in prison. Like they've gotten their GED. They did all this stuff. And so usually they're more likely to be paroled.
Yep.
Like the case – the Slenderman case.
Exactly. Oh, that was so soon though.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's the case of Skylar Nice, and hopefully they don't get out.
Dang. But we shall see. That's scary because they're a lot older than the Wisconsin one. They were 12.
Yeah.
Which 12 and 16 don't sound like a big difference, but they're a big difference.
It is.
Like it's a drastic, like one year in middle school and one year in high school.
Yeah. It's like different worlds, honestly.
Yeah. Dang.
Yeah. So what are you going to tell us about?
Okay. So I wasn't going to cover it at first because I was nervous that it was like a really well-known case.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked two of my coworkers if they knew about this case and they said no. So I was like, all right, we're just going to roll with it.
Okay.
And so if you're super familiar with this case, I apologize, but I thought it was really cool and I wanted to talk about it. Well, not really cool. It's just a really weird case. And it happened around Christmas time. So with us recording in December, I was like, this fits perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so I got a lot of the information for this case from an online article from the Smithsonian Magazine. So I wanted to shout that out and cite that first.
Nice.
All right. We are talking about the Sodder children.
This sounds familiar, but I honestly could not tell you what it's about.
Okay, good.
Okay.
So a little background on this family. George and Jenny Sauter were two Italian immigrants who were raising their large family in Fayetteville, West Virginia. Fayetteville is a very small town, as in the population is only 3,000. So it's a place where everyone knows everyone, and word, if there is any, spreads throughout the town quickly. It is still a small town today, actually, with a population of 2,892 as of 2010. But at this time, the town had a small but very active community of Italian immigrants. George Sauter had been born in 1895 in Tula, Sardinia, and was born under the name Biorgio Sodu.
I was going to say that his name does not sound Italian.
Yeah.
But that one does.
Yep. He immigrated to the United States in 1908 when he was only 13 years old. He came in through Ellis Island and was accompanied by his older brother. But once they reached Ellis Island, his brother turned around and returned to Italy, which meant George was on his own. He eventually found work and was able to move to Smithers, West Virginia. One day, his life started to fall into place when he walked into a local store called Music Box and met the owner's daughter, Jenny Cipriani. Jenny had also been an immigrant from Italy who came to the U.S. when she was three. They got married and had their first child in 1923, their last in 1943. So the Sauter family consisted of George and Jenny, then their children, Marion, Sylvia, John, George Jr., Maurice, Martha, Louis, Jenny, and Betty.
Is that 10?
That is 9. 9 children. Well, there were actually 10, but one son was away for the army.
Okay.
So the Sauter family was known to be a very respected middle-class family. George was also known as having very strong opinions about many things, from business to politics to current events. Though he was boisterous through these topics, that's the right word, right? Boisterous.
Yeah.
I thought it was boisterous, and nowhere in the world could I find boisterous. And I was like, I swear this is a word.
I mean, boisterous makes sense because it's like having voice on something.
Yeah. And then one day I was thinking about it, I was like, oh, it's boisterous. That's
well,
what
you
the word
can
is.
Say boisterous, and I'll accept that.
Okay, thank you.
Cool.
So he was boisterous about these topics, but he was very hesitant to talk about his childhood. He never did say what happened back in Italy that made him want to come to the U.S. So in the early morning hours of December 24th, 1945, Christmas Eve, the Sauter's home phone rang. Jenny answered the phone to a strange woman on the other end who was asking for someone that Jenny didn't know. She told her that she had the wrong number, but before Jenny could hang up, the strange lady started laughing loudly. There was also the sound of clinking glasses in the background. Jenny hung up, and as she was making her way back upstairs, she noticed the lights were still on downstairs and the curtains were still open. As she went back down to turn off the lights and close the curtains, she noticed Marion asleep on the sofa in the living room. So she turned off the lights, closed the curtain, locked the door, and went upstairs to go to bed. Just as she was about to fall asleep, Jenny heard a loud bang on the roof, followed by a rolling noise. I guess she wasn't too concerned as she fell asleep. But she was woken up around 1 a.m. to the smell of smoke. A room that George had used as his office was the source of the fire due to a telephone and fuse box right on the outside of the house. George, Jenny, and four of their children, Marion, who was 17, and Sylvia, who was 2, the two youngest daughters, and John, 23, and George Jr., 16, who were the two oldest sons, made it out of the house. But unfortunately, Maurice, who was 14, Martha, who was 12, Louis, who was 9, Jenny, who was 8, and Betty, who were 5, did not.
Aww.
So, frantic, George needed to find a way into the house. At first, he broke one of the downstairs windows with his fist, resulting in a bleeding wound. But when he looked in the window, he could barely see a thing through the smoke and flames. George then ran to the side of his house where he kept his ladder, hoping that he would be able to climb into the children's room to get them out that way. But when he arrived at the spot where his ladder always stood, it was missing. So he ran to his truck, thinking that he could back it up right below the window and climb in that way instead. The truck had worked perfectly the day before, but when he tried to start it, it wouldn't start.
No.
George's mind was racing as he tried to think of another option. Then it hit him. They had a rain barrel next to the house. Though not ideal, he decided to try scooping water out and throwing it at the house. But it was December, and December gets cold in West Virginia, so the water in that barrel was frozen solid. Marion, one of the daughters who made it out of the house, ran to their neighbor's house to call the Fayette Fire Department, but there was no response from the operator on the other end of the line. A neighbor close by saw the flame and ran to the local tavern to call the fire department as well, but was met with the same dead end with no operator response. The neighbor decided to do what he had to do, so he jumped in his car and drove into town. He tracked down Fire Chief F.J. Morris, who then initiated the Fayetteville fire alarm. This is the stupidest fire alarm. It's a phone tree system. So one firefighter calls another, who then calls another, who then calls another.
Oh my gosh, imagine how lost the message could get.
Uh-huh. But that's how they round up the firefighters. They're like, oh, hey, there's a fire, tell so-and-so. Oh, hey, there's a fire, tell so-and-so. And that's how they round up all the firefighters.
What a nightmare.
Yeah. Well, it took less than an hour for the house to become totally engulfed in flames. At around 8 a.m. on Christmas morning now, the fire department finally arrived. That is 7 hours after the fire started.
My gosh.
And the so-called fire alarm went out. Oddly enough, though, the fire department was only 2.5 miles away from the Sauter house. Someone could literally crawl 2.5 miles faster than it took the fire department to show
up. Yeah.
By the time they finally showed up, the house was reduced to nothing more than a smoking pile of ashes. With the fire out and the house now nothing more than a burning pile of ashes, it was believed that the 5 Sauter children had died in the fire. George and Jenny believed it too. But the weird and unsettling part, as they searched the grounds and the rubble that had once been their house, no traces were found of the 5 children.
Oh.
None at all.
Oh.
Chief Morris suggested that maybe the fire had been hot enough to completely cremate the bodies. Well, a small investigation took place, as it does, and it was determined that the cause of the fire was faulty wiring. Before the new year even came, the coroner's office had issued 5 death certificates for the 5 children, stating the cause of death as either suffocation or fire. While Jenny and George were having a hard time believing that there were absolutely no remains left of their children in their rooms, how is it that their children supposedly died in the house, but there was absolutely nothing left?
There would have been bones, teeth, like something.
Uh-huh. So this got Jenny thinking, and she soon began to conduct some experiments. She collected different animal bones and joints to see if a fire would, in fact, completely burn them.
Right.
Each time she conducted the experiment, she was always left with a pile of charred bones, clearly not all burned.
Wow.
She even knew that there had been pieces left of household appliances, which made no sense how some things would have still remained.
Mm-hmm.
Jenny even reached out to a local crematorium and spoke to an employee there. The employee informed her that bones still remain after a body had been burned at 2,000 degrees for 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
The Sauter house burned for only 45 minutes. So literally no way.
Yeah.
And it makes sense why the family believed that their 5 children had been kidnapped. They believed that the fire had been used as a distraction or to abduct the children. At this time, they also began recalling unusual events before the fire. First was the phone call that Jenny received right before the fire started from a person she didn't know. Another thought that came back to the couple had occurred a few months prior. A stranger had approached the Sauter house and was asking about hauling work. He then walked around to the back of the house where the fuse box was located and told the family that that would cause a fire one day. It was a very odd comment to make in general, but also odd because the house had actually recently been serviced by an electrician. They also had another man randomly come up to the house and try to sell the family life insurance. George declined, which really angered the man. He yelled at George and said, quote, "Your goddamn house is going up in smoke and your children are going to be destroyed. You are going to be paid for the dirty remarks you have been making about Mussolini."
Oh.
Like the dictator Mussolini.
Yeah.
Well, earlier, I mentioned that Greg was very boisterous.
Yeah.
And was very vocal and outspoken about his beliefs. Well, he had indeed spoken about his dislike for the Italian dictator Mussolini, which oftentimes led to heated arguments between George and the other Italian members of his community. Also, one of the older sons had recalled that right before Christmas, he had noticed a man was parked along U.S. Highway 21. This man would watch the younger Sauter children as they came home from school.
Oh, gosh.
All of these things together pretty much prompted the family to spend most of their life savings on detectives to find out the truth. This is when they hired Detective C.C. Tinsley. Tinsley did some digging and found out that the insurance salesman who had pretty much harassed George was actually a member of the coroner's jury who decided that the fire was accidental. Tinsley also overheard some interesting information. So remember how at the fire, Chief Morris had said that no remains had been found?
Mm-hmm.
No remains had been found? I always say words okay. Weird and then people call out.
Oh, I thought you were saying something about that.
No. Well, Tinsley apparently heard that Morris had actually found a heart within the ashes. Morris said he had hid it in a dynamite box and buried it on the property. So he was somehow able to convince Morris to show him the spot where he had supposedly buried the heart. They found the box and immediately brought it to a local funeral director. Well, it turns out that this heart wasn't a heart at all. It was a beef liver. And actually, this liver hadn't been touched by the fire at all. So rumors started to spread about this as well.
Mm-hmm.
The rumor was that the fire chief didn't actually find the liver at all at the scene of the fire. He had placed the liver in the rubble knowing he would find it. He hoped that this would be evidence enough for the Sauter family to stop the investigation, believing it was remains of their children, so the investigation into their disappearance would be over. And even then, the odd moments surrounding the case kept coming. After some more investigation, a telephone repairman told the company that their phones hadn't been burned in the fire. They had been cut.
Oh.
Which could make sense why they could never get to the operator. Also, the official cause of the fire had been faulty wiring. Well, if this is the case, how are the lights able to remain on downstairs? The lights that Jenny remembers turning off only an hour before the house caught on fire. Another witness eventually came forward, saying that during the whole fire scene, they had seen a man taking away a block and tackle, like one used for removing a car's engine. This part was kind of weird. I was like, how do you know that there was a person removing a block and tackle? But it was listed in many articles, so. Huh. And how his car wouldn't start makes sense now.
Yeah.
Also, one day, while the family was visiting the site of their old house, Sylvia found something in the yard. It was a hard rubber object. So remember the sound Jenny heard on the roof with the bang and the rolling?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was probably this rubber thing. George concluded that it had been a napalm pineapple bomb, so a type of bomb used typically in warfare. So threw it on there, you know. In 1947, George and Jenny even wrote and sent a letter about their case and the situation to the FBI. J. Edgar Hoover sent them a reply saying pretty much that it was a local matter and that it didn't qualify to come within the FBI's jurisdiction. But there were agents who said they would assist in all investigations if they got the proper approval from the local authorities. But interesting...
The local authorities didn't want their help.
Interestingly enough, the Fayetteville Police and Fire Departments all declined this offer.
Wow.
So they declined the help of the FBI.
Wow.
Uh-huh. In August of 1949, the family decided that they wanted to conduct another search throughout the rubble, so they brought in Oscar B. Hunter, a pathologist from Washington, D.C.
Nice.
They carefully combed through all of the rubble and found some small things like damaged coins, a dictionary that had been partially burned, and several shards of vertebrae. These bones were sent to the Smithsonian Institute for testing. The report that came back said, quote, "The human bones consist of four lumbar vertebrae belonging to one individual. Since the transverse recesses are fused, the age of this individual at death should have been 16 or 17 years. The top limit of age should be about 22 since the centra, which normally fuse at 23, are still unfused. On this basis, the bones show greater skeletal maturation than one would expect for a 14-year-old boy, who was the age of the oldest missing solder child. It is possible, however, although not probable, for a boy 14 and a half years old to show 16 to 17 maturation. So the bones also showed no evidence that they had been in the fire either. It is also weird that only these four vertebrae were found and not five full skeletons.
Right.
So after this incident, George had filled the basement of the house with soil to make the area a sort of memorial for the family.
Mm-hmm.
The report concluded that the most likely explanation for these bones is that they just happened to be in the soil that he used to fill in the basement. Which isn't any more comforting or any less confusing as to why these bones are in any other area of soil.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that they end up here just, like, isn't the concern. It's the fact that why are these bones in soil?
Exactly.
You know?
It so doesn't add up. It's,
right.
Like, scientifically.
It's just weird.
Yeah. Sorry about that interruption. We'll cut it out. But someone tried to sell stuff to me at the door, and I tried to tell them no, and you know how that goes.
I know. I was nervous. I was like, I don't ever open the door.
I know. I didn't know what to do.
I always make Joe do it.
That's good. Yeah.
I'm like, Joe,
yeah.
Answer the door.
I need to learn, but I live on the edge, so.
Oh, my God.
I take elevators that might be breaking down, so.
A rebel over here. All right. So these reports from the Smithsonian actually prompted some action. Two hearings took place at the Capitol in Charleston, but it was declared that the search for the Charleston races.
Is it
town
slots?
Or it's ten? Charleston. Races and slots. Yeah, it's Charleston.
Charleston?
Yeah.
What?
So Charleston,
West Virginia.
Races and slots.
That's Charleston.
No, it's Ton.
Is it?
I looked it up.
I remember the commercial is like Charleston races.
It says Ton. Charleston.
Ellie.
All right, well, the article said Charleston, so I will say Charlestown. Huh. These reports from the Smithsonian actually prompted some action. Two hearings took place at the Capitol in Charlestown, but it was declared that the search for the children was, quote, hopeless, and the case was officially closed. But the Sodders knew that this wasn't the end, so they put up a billboard along Route 16. The billboard asked for any information on the children, with a $5,000 reward being offered. The amount was soon increased to $10,000. This billboard actually prompted some tips to come in about the children. A letter arrived from a woman who lived in St. Louis who said that Martha, one of the daughters, was in a convent there. Another tip came from someone in Texas. They said, while in a bar, they heard another patron having a, quote, incriminating conversation about a long-ago Christmas Eve fire in West Virginia. Another tip came in from Florida that said that the children were staying with one of Jenny's distant relatives. Each time a new tip came in, George would travel to that location to follow up, but sadly, none of the tips amounted to anything.
Hmm.
But in 1968, 23 years later, the family received a mysterious letter in the mail that was postmarked from Kentucky with no return address. Inside the envelope was a photo of a young man in his 20s who looked very similar to Lewis Sauter. The photograph was described to be a picture of Lewis Sauter, obviously much older, and on the back was a message that read, quote, "Lewis Sauter, I love brother Frankie, ILI boys, A90132, or it could have been 90135.
What?
Super weird, doesn't make any sense. Tinsley was once again called by the family when the letter with the photograph was received. He was sent to Kentucky to get more information about this photo, but while there, Tinsley vanished. He was never seen or heard from again.
What?
So let's talk about some of the other sightings of the children that have been reported. Right after the incident, one woman claimed that she had seen the children in a car that was driving by her while the fire was burning. Another woman, who worked at a tourist stop between Fayetteville and Charlestown.
Charlestown.
Faces and slots. Said that she had seen the children the morning after the fire. She had even told the police that she had served them breakfast. She also remembers seeing a car with Florida license plates at the center as well. Another sighting was reported by a woman at a hotel in Charlestown. She remembers seeing the photos of the children in a newspaper and recalls seeing 4 out of the 5 of them a week after the fire. She said that the children had been accompanied by 2 men and 2 women, all of Italian descent. The women said in a statement, quote, I do not remember the exact date. However, the entire party did register at the hotel and stayed in a large room with several beds. They registered about midnight. I tried to talk to the children in a friendly manner, but the men appeared hostile and refused to allow me to talk to these children. One of the men looked at me in a hostile manner. He turned around and began talking rapidly in Italian. Immediately, the whole family stopped talking to me. I sensed that I was being frozen out, and so I said nothing more. They left early the next morning.
Wow.
A few years later, George was looking at a newspaper and saw a photo of school children in New York City. He was convinced that one of the girls in the photo was his daughter, Betty. So he drove to Manhattan in an attempt to find the girl. I guess he found the house, but the girl's parents refused to talk to him.
I mean, that would be really creepy. I get it.
I do too. I do too. You can't just be like, hey, I think your daughter is my daughter.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, none of these sightings or reports ever amounted to anything. George died in 1969. His cause of death is said to have been from a broken heart.
Stop.
I know. Jenny passed away. I know. Jenny passed away in 1988. Both George and Jenny died without ever knowing what happened to their 5 missing children. But their family kept looking and searching for anything about this case, and they came up with a few theories about what happened. So their theories are, the local mafia had tried to recruit George and he declined. They tried to get money from him and he refused. So in both of these cases, the denial would have been what prompted violent action.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Because you're messing with the mob.
And the mob is sneaky like that.
Like the local mafia and stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's all like...
And he's Italian.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Another theory is that an illegal child-selling agency took the children. Another is that the children had been kidnapped by someone who they knew. So they explain this theory as someone who the family knew came into the house before the fire through the unlocked front door.
And lured them out, probably.
He went up to the kids' room and told them that a fire was about to start and that he would take them somewhere safe. So obviously, if the children knew this person, they wouldn't have questioned the person and would have willingly left
with
them.
Right, because they're innocent.
Exactly, and they wouldn't have alerted their parents. You know, if you know the person, you're going to trust them.
Right.
The family also believes that maybe it really was Lewis who was in the photo and that he is out there somewhere. Sylvia was the youngest surviving daughter, only 2 at the time of the fire. In 2012, when the article I mentioned was published, she was 69. She doesn't believe that her siblings died in the fire, but sadly, she is no closer to finding out the truth now than she was then.
Aww.
So that is the story of the mysterious Sauter children.
Wow.
Had you ever heard of it before?
No. I mean, it sounds familiar, but I don't know if I'm just making that up in my head. But that is very eerie.
Yeah. And, like, I was like, well, I don't want to cover it. Like,
no,
you know,
I'm glad
people probably know it. And I was like, no, I'm going to cover this one.
And it is, like, really heartbreaking that the family, like, couldn't move on because they didn't have answers.
Yep.
They weren't able to let go. Not having closure, I'm sure, can have so many effects that you can't see, like, mental effects.
And all of the, like, not backlash, but all of the dead ends they were reaching where, like, you know, they were like, something, like, weird and suspicious is going on. And then the fire department's like, no, it's not. And then the FBI is like, we'll help. And the fire department's like, no, you won't.
You know, it's
just – and it makes me wonder if people who are running those are people that didn't like George.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's the reason why they took 7 hours to get 2.5 miles away.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, just very suspicious.
Or, like, I know the mafia would pay off the police.
Mm.
So maybe the police were either threatened or being paid off, and that's why they didn't want the FBI involvement. That's why they took so long to get there.
That's a good point.
Because it just aligned so perfectly so that they were kind of, like, away, like, mm-hmm. a level of, you know, being removed from the situation.
Yeah.
So,
but yeah, so
wow.
That's the case. Super weird, super mysterious. Literally still no one knows what happened, why it happened. No one knows where the kids are.
Wow. What year was this again? So this would have been like the early
1900s. 1945.
Okay. So the year that World War II ended.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's interesting.
Because that would be a lot of the
immigrants coming.
Well, because they were already there. But true. 1945 would have been, you know, things were bad over there. So maybe family. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, that was a real, I'm really glad you covered that.
Thank you.
That was really good.
I think we had some interesting stories this week.
I think so, yeah.
All right, well, again, we just want to say thank you to everyone for sticking around and listening to us or finding us new and liking us and sticking around. It's very exciting.
It really is. It means so much to us. And don't forget to email us your stories. If you have any scary stories that have happened to you, email us at ascarystatepodcast@gmail.com because we're getting ready to release our listener episode. So we want to put you in the next one.
It's so exciting.
Yes, I can't wait.
And then follow us on all social medias at A Scary State Podcast. And I think that's it.
Yeah. Thank you, guys. Stay scary.
Stay safe.